The next slide shows the continuation of the incentive of the hydrogen program. At program level, one of the key factors, items that need to be taken into account in terms of the percentage spent against the budget. And there's other provision now there, it kind of indicates you. If you spend, for example, between 95% and 100% of your budget, which means that you are sitting here at very excellent, you are breaking the fund. You are good, I mean, you can go beyond and improving your capability of your spending. And the second one is the average time that you use in awarding the tender. If you tender for less than 30 days, where you are on top of your game, average prompt payment time, you say 30 days, you are also paid within, within 30 days, you are on top of your game. And if you take more than 90 days, then maybe there is a serious challenge that the particular government department has. And the percentage of tenders cancelled, if it's more than 10%, there is also something that maybe went wrong in that particular tender. So those are things, those are the indicators that there is actually a problem. And then if the project is terminated, I mean, it becomes worse. If the project has already been awarded and now it becomes terminated, you're sitting above 2%, then it becomes a problem. Because now it means that we are going to go back to the drawing board and re-advertise, do all the things that that might even delay the project further. And then if there's a percentage, 5% more that's related to unprotected work stoppages on site, it's time, that is just a very big influence on how you're going to deliver your project on time, cost, and quality. If you move beyond that 5%, those are green lights or signals that something needs to be actually be done. And those are the things that we say that they can assist the committee in doing their effective oversight when they're looking at the big issues. Chair, I think I'm going close to my conclusion. The issue about, I've mentioned the issue of the register of project, and it was also mentioned that for register of project, for public sector project, the project should be above the value of 200,000. For public entities and private sector, it should be above 10 million. That information, Chair, is very critical for our purposes, and our register of project need some kind of assistance to make sure that there is full compliance in terms of making sure that that information is populated into our register of project. I think, Chair, the next slide, it just gives you a breakdown of a compliance level that we're sitting with currently in terms of the register of project, in as far as attendant notices that are supposed to be advertised on our register of project. For district municipalities and overage, we're sitting at 53%. For local municipality, we're sitting at 51%. For the metro, sitting at 39%. For municipal entities, we're sitting at 63%. For national department, we're sitting at 58%. For provincial department, we're sitting at 60% in terms of compliance with the register of project. I think the note that is included there, Chair, is very critical. We are looking forward to the support of this committee so that we can actually make sure that we are doing our monitoring in terms of the register of project, and that's our main thing and our main issues related to compliance by the custodian clients in terms of making sure the information is available on the register of project. And I think, Chair, as a close departing shot, it is important to say that all we just said needs to be documented. All these contracting strategies that the client they need to adopt, it is very important that they are documented so that we have a basis for referring back and then to understand the rationale of why certain decisions were taken at a certain point. On that note, Chair, thank you very much.
Honourable members, much, and thank you for the presentation.
Perhaps the first thing that I would like to just speak to is the issue of your indicators. I don't know if you write them like that. That I think you did mention also that they are negative, that we've got, like, when you look at the construction industry indicators, it would be so good. I mean, it's fine, but it would be good to just get the positive performance rather than the negative performance. But perhaps we've got the reasons. And then on slide 31, where you say non-performance, then you have indicated that over 100 public sector contracts have been terminated because of failure to perform. But below that, you are saying many of the terminations were because of non-payment by the client. So it says now is a non-performance by the client now in this case. So it is a little bit confusing because it's non-performance of contractors or of the client. But on this one, I think you corrected it when you presented that it's billions here, because I was looking at the millions and thinking of the huge budget that obviously if people underspend by 2 million, what percentage would it be of that? But I think you did correct it, because I was surprised that it was millions. I'll just touch on a few. Actually, on this slide number 35, you spoke to it, Acting CEO, quite well on those points there, but I wasn't sure what it means when you say, does a policy exist on contracting strategies that is dependent on capacity? Just the meaning of that, in as much as you spoke to the all the items below that, I honestly was not able to make out what it is, how does it depend on that? So if you can just speak to that. On the next slide, 36, I saw that although you've written provisional, the scaling there, I was looking at your rating, poor, adequate, and good. Would you say 90 to 95% is good? I would argue that it is not good, because you are saying that you can actually call an under expenditure of 10% good. It cannot be. For me, it cannot be. So it's simply the rating that I'm not quite comfortable with, that you can call it good as a. No, I think I'll limit myself to those for now.
I just wanted to ask a just broad general question about your relationship with the PICC. Yes, this Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. It seems to me that a lot of coordinated action needs to take place on infrastructure for it to be successful, and each role player should feature one way or the other in the processes. Now, in the absence of kind of relationship, and especially with the PICC, it becomes difficult to see the bigger picture of the infrastructure build program of government. Yes, I know you are taking us through the parts thereof, which is important. intent was to be able to identify gaps and do our oversight. But again, we do want to see that bigger picture, because one of the questions, for instance, which bothers this committee, is how many years now are we in this infrastructure program introduced by the president? Was it 2009, 2010, thereabouts? Yeah. And some of those who are experts in costings are suggesting that by 2030, and this is the NDP time span, will have cost something like 4 trillion rand. Now that's huge. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, infrastructure by its very nature, which is as huge as ours, is supposed to stimulate economic growth. And I dare say, as this committee, Chairperson, we haven't seen that. And we would like to see it. For many reasons, but one very specific reason is the more economic activity in the country, the more the tax base, the more money into the fiscus, and the more money appropriated to departments, and the more and better services to our people. So it's a whole cycle. Now, so this is the reason why we are raising these questions, and precisely the reason we called you to say, help us to be able to see what we don't see. Thank you.
But our only sector in the country that's still in technical recession. The rest of the country has escaped technical recession.
Just on the last point, it's usually the construction industry that gets hit first by a recession and recovers last, so it's not really surprising if there were sectors left. But I'm just generally, I find it a little difficult to answer questions in the sense that the good people here before us came to give us training, and our sort of natural inclination here is to start giving them oversight and ask those kind of questions. So, you know, I'm tempted to ask them what their budget is and what value for money we're getting out of your budget. But I guess it's not really where we're at today. But two comments I have. You haven't mentioned either two things that I think are essential in the kind of function you're telling us about, and I'd like to hear about it. One of them is quality control. I haven't heard anything about, maybe it's still to come in the presentations, but because all we've heard about here is how we get the jobs going right. Go through the whole process of initiation, planning, but now once the contract is on the ground and the job's being done, I don't get anything there. We seem to have stopped now. We're comfortable. The contract is on site, got all the procurement issues sorted out, the planning's been done, now we sit back and relax. But now is when the trouble starts. Now when the bricks are being laid and the bags of cement are vanishing out the back door and all the rest of it that goes wrong on construction sites. Can you address that issue for me a little? The other thing I see is in the contracts themselves that you talk about, I don't see anything there that says if the contractor or the implementing agent doesn't do what he's supposed to do, what consequences are there? Do we have any clauses in these contracts that talk about if you breach the agreement? And that's where there should be some essential oversight going on, surely, that if the contract is breached, then those consequences that are provided for when the agreement must come into force, they must be implemented. Because that seems to be a big lack we have as well, that there's no follow-through. Certainly in some of the oversight we've been on where we've asked questions, it seems like something happens and that's it. It's identified, oh yes, there was a problem there, or somebody did something. I'm sure my committee members will remember the 315,000 rand tap we saw in the Eastern Cape. But there's no consequence. There's a budget for 315,000 rand, they threw a piece of concrete, piece of cement around a standpipe in the ground the morning before we got there. And you think, how can this be? And yet there's no follow-through. There's no answer back afterwards to say, well, actually this and that guy's now been fired or somebody else had to pay money back. That's why I'm asking from an oversight point of view. That's what I'm wanting to hear from you. What do we have in place? Or can you show us where to go and get that information? Where we can find out, have these things you've spoken about to us, have they happened? Are you in possession of all the stuff? Can you say to us, look, there's a problem here. We suggest you go and do some oversight there because these things aren't in place. And then lastly, Madam Chair, if I may, I just had a bit of a thought, I know it's been mentioned already, but an overlapping of roles. This thing with the Office of the Procurement, the Chief Procurement Officer, because that surely is where all the procurement should happen and those where the policy should be set up. But now we're talking about each department having its own policy. Are they in line with the OCPO's policies, or are they separate? Do we look at it in any way? And just for example, yourselves and the CBE, the built environment. Is there any overlap between what you're doing, what they're doing, and between yourselves and the Department of Public Works themselves? How do you differentiate what you're doing with what they're doing? Thank you, Chair.
Just to piggyback on what my colleague Honorable McLaughlin has raised, I don't know whether it's related to slide 31 on non-performance. There have been times when we that a contractor having been awarded a contract, starting to doing work somewhere in the middle of carrying out the contract, some differences arose. The contractor is cancelled. But by the time that contract is cancelled and the work is midway, at whatever stage, so many millions have been paid to the contractor. And then he goes away with those millions. One time we were looking at the Asidi projects, and we heard that the work that contractor had done up to that point, just about halfway up the walls, can't recall whether it was the project manager or who do you call these people who assess each stage of the building, was saying this thing has got to be brought down and started all over again because shoddy work has been done. But the money is gone, 18 million rand gone. So, and I'm saying it relates to what Honorable McLachlan is asking, and perhaps to this slide as well, because you're saying part of the problem of non-completion of project is because clients don't pay. So, if you could clarify those things, because we find it rather strange that midway along the project, X amount of money is already paid, but the contract is cancelled. Some new contractor must now take over and build on and so on. Or sometimes the whole thing is going to be collapsed and restarted. Thank you.
30 minutes.
30 minutes. Yeah. 30 minutes. Let's take 30 minutes lunch break. Thank you very much. And then we start to be a balance. No, the food there.
Yeah,
I leave at 3 for a flight of 5:30.
Yes, I don't mind. I just be told what to do. Do I leave there at 2 o'clock or do I drive down to
What kind of thing is it? Because it will present the last part and then But she's got a presentation. She's got a computer.
having it shortly.
Thank you. We're continuing with the third
presentation.
Oh,
you know.
Oh, they said twice. Is that
no,
Tuna?
They moved it to two.
Of course.
Very well.
Announcement and food. This is not important. No, the tuna. When you know food, you're behind. Thank you.
person is going to motivate for me. Yeah. I'll assess how things are going there.
What time is your flight? We must be out of here. I went through good forward I'm gonna challenge you email. I can access internet email. I've tried it. Now here's another challenge. You won't take a it's the last flight now. I'm gonna leave my friend.
And I keep on forgetting.
Come calling to another community. You don't take a salary because there's a suggestion now we finish by three. The presidential go over three. And I can walk over three, then I'm going to miss that.
Okay.
So you might also check a bit. That's why I didn't have to check a 9 from one of them. This might be the last one. So, I'm not sure what's happening. Okay. Or on the better message. Thank you. afraid that's what my business is.
Mm-hmm.
They find themselves, they find that you're so busy. Everyone is so busy and tired.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way.
There's nothing that will show.
Nothing is really show. How do you find your things? How do you think doing your No.
You know, I always say that just you are too busy.
Yes, but I mean the other thing is, you know, these committees are very scary by nature. Just thinking of appearing at the committee, and it's because I think we always see them on TV. They can be very brutal. No, I'm just saying committees
general.
So that's why when you hear that you must appear. And you're thinking about the seven reasons. It doesn't exactly. I'm gonna. Sorry. Half a thing. You know, yesterday at my collection, same thing. Asked me to get to go. This is you and in the line of questioning.
Thank you. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, shall we settle down so that we can start with our afternoon meeting and continue where we left off.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to ask Rodney to try to do
responses,
responses to the register of projects, questions that related to the register of projects.
Thank you, Chair. I want to respond broadly to some of those that are dealing with the registered projects and maybe also some others which I want to pick up. There was a question around this huge variation. If maybe I can try and answer this question about the huge variation in projects due to prices. The reasons for huge project variations are typically, very often, design changes which the client during construction. And there are, it could be poor design, it could be poor planning, and yes, it could be unforeseen soil circumstances or it could be contractor delays. But in most cases, cost overruns and some costs on projects go tenfold over, but that's the huge exception. Most of your medium-sized projects, 50, 100 million rand, you typically do not get those type of cost overruns at the mega projects, but it's very often poor planning, poor design, design changes, influences by the client during the thing. There were several, you requested information around projects. We will extract all the project information that we have, and I understand that you're talking over 2 years. So whatever project's being awarded, which is on our register over the period that you're looking at, we just need to confirm the dates, but I can send them to you. But we only have, first of all, we've got poor compliance, but we don't have work project plans submitted. We have budget, we have Not budget, we have award value, we have project name, we have project location, we have contractor, then we have all the attributes associated with the contractor. The information we get, because of clients not letting us know, is incomplete, but we'll let you have whatever we got and we can take it from there. There was a question, if I can just touch sides on quality. Are we looking at quality? Quality is a big issue. I will look at that. I will make some reference to that in a subsequent presentation. But if I can just refer to the issue of quality, there was also reference to a contract where someone said midway during at the height of the construction that one, the quality is poor and must be broken down. That's a contractual issue, and the client should never have allowed it to get to that stage before the client discovered that the quality was poor. The client should be meeting at least once a month with the client's representative, the client's agent. In fact, weekly, but at least once a month. And in some cases, there's got to be a client's agent on site every for whenever the thing. So again, it points back to, I believe, clients, and where there is a breach of contract, clients have to follow through. You know, to say that one has got halfway spent 130 million rand, that's a breach of contract. And one should be recovering that money in terms of the triple PFA. The one thing which we may just want to mention, you know, I know National Treasury were establishing an unit to go out and inspect all these sites to pick up this, you know, 13 million rand for a little concrete round a tap. That, again, that's just a breach of contract, and that person should be prosecuted for that. The CIDB is aiming to establish an inspectorate as part of our plan to address certain issues as well. I think, let me just leave it there. I don't know if you want me to pick up any others, or is it adequate?
Fine, Roger. I'll deal with that for balance, and I'll ask for help. The first, I'm going to start from the top. On the aspect in respect of construction indicators, of not just being told the negative things and also to be told indicators that are positive, I think the comment is well taken. We will not just have a pessimistic view, also look for the positive things that are happening in the sector. Then there was a question that followed in respect of the hydro public sector projects that have failed, and asking if there a contradiction. Who is the cause factor? Is it the client or is it the contractor? The way, and you will correct me, Dr. Mulford, I have read that information, is that it is saying because clients were not processing payments, it has caused for contract cancellation being initiated by the contractor. Mm-hmm. To say, I am repudiating this contract because you've already repudiated by not meeting payment conditions. Mm-hmm. It's saying the majority of them are as a consequence of clients not paying. And I think one of the key things to note from my knowledge of the industry is that, one, contractors' cash flow is king. They are relying on using their working capital to carry them till they are paid their next invoice. Now, you can only imagine if a contract is big and on them to finance it off their balance sheet. And by financing on their balance sheet, they're exposed to credit agreements. After 21 days, as we all know, interest starts to accrue on any facility, credit facility you may have. Now, if they don't get paid in terms of the stipulated times of invoicing, when they do accept that in a normal cycle, even before you invoice, you already incur an expenditure in anything for 60 to 90 days. Because the count of the 90 days is only after your certificate has been actually acknowledged by the resident engineer on site, which then can be processed for invoicing. At that point in time, a contractor is already in credit facilities for about 60 days. So if you're in a large contract and you are not being paid, you could be, just to protect your own assets, say, thank you very much, I'm going to cut my losses and stop here right now. So what that slide is communicating is that it's because of non-payment, which is repudiating the contract. But there was also a request that said, you would want to know which of these, what are these 100 public sector contracts, and we must make that information available. I was requested to go back and try to explain slide 35. I want to find an easier, I want to try to be more practical in terms of explaining it. I'm trying to look for another slide that can assist. Which aspect, ma'am? In essence, we are trying to communicate is that the choice of your procurement policy that you have made is a function of your capacity. Because if you have a particular level of capacity, there would be an appropriate contracting strategy for that capacity. Practical example. All right, I will use an example. I'm from the Eastern Cape, so I can be abused for using, let's say, Eastern Cape municipality. Let's assume I'm in Amatole municipality. And Amatole municipality has no built environment professional within the employ of the municipality. But the municipality knows that they need to build a bridge, as an example, for the community in between the wards. Now, in such a situation, the municipality can prepare a briefing document of saying, at this particular location, we require a bridge that will be able to commute normal cars and people can also walk over. But beyond that, I can't tell you what should be the spec of that bridge, what should be its span designs, what should be its weight loads, and all of the other wonderful things. In such a situation, then we are then saying, you would then go for the option of choosing the contracting strategy of management contractor. Because in that procurement strategy, the person you would appoint would then have to go into all the design things which you can't do on your side. But let's assume I'm in Buffalo City municipality, which is around East London Metro. And in the East London Metro, I find that there I do have engineers. I do have people who can design. And the metro can actually make a design. In such a situation, it would be more appropriate because they can produce the production information to go out on tender for a bridge to be built. In that instance, the design by employer. In short, I'm trying to say the choice you make on the procurement strategy is a function of your capacity. I think now I get the question. I think I missed it a bit. Think, does a policy exist? If we go back to slide 8, the one in the beginning, it says on slide 8, organs of state who are responsible for infrastructure delivery shall establish a suitable infrastructure procurement and delivery supply management policy to implement the standard. So that first part is speaking to that. Does a policy exist? Have you chosen a policy that is specifying either one contracting strategy or a cocktail of construction strategies you will use in the infrastructure delivery? That is what we are saying. We're just creating a connection with that requirement.
The question that I ask, are they aware? Because
ma'am, to the best of my knowledge is that everybody was made aware of the standard in 2015. As to whether or not everyone comprehended what the standard meant, I think it's a very different answer. I have the distinct impression from where I'm sitting that there has not been an appreciation of what the standard means. I accept. I accept it, ma'am. Unfortunately, it's not my area. It's a national treasure. The standard is a product of. I think I'm going to take that counsel. I want to answer it in the context of the question. There was a question that said, what is our relationship with the PICC and CPO? I will say our relationship with National Treasury is on the mend. That would be the best way to characterize it. It's on the mend.
We
But now it's on the maps. I'm trying to explain, you asking the question, why not? It was on the maps. It's on the maps. I accept that, ma'am. We will fix it. What was the problem? Can I ask Ms. George? Okay, all right, I will answer that, okay?
She came up with it.
What was the problem? The problem arose as a consequence of us having a joint mandate in terms of procurement. That is where the problem arose. It manifested itself in different formats, in contestation of saying who should be doing what at what level. At some point they believed we have no role, we should just shut down, they will take care of everything. But we said we've got an act, our act is very clear, this is not your space, it's our space. So there was a fight. I'm calling it what it was. And we have gone through a process of agreeing to have an instrument, the MOA we concluded last year, to find each other so we can work together in this space.
Well, we are sponsored by two entities. The standard is National Treasury. Our act is sponsored by the Ministry of Finance.
No, I'm saying the standard.
Mm-hmm. The standard is National Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I realize the interest.
Chairperson, on the issue of the criteria being used on slide 56, I accept the variance that if I read the PFMA correctly, it says we have an allowance of 5%, that then goods should be at that particular level. It can't be that below that compliance level of goods in terms of unaccountable page. Our relationship with PICC and the CPO, I think I've spoken to the issue of the CPO, which is the office within the National Treasury. In the context of the PICC, I would want to say we are involved, and I would also like maybe to speak to that involvement in detail, but our view is that it's not an appropriate thing, because the PICC is overlooking the SIPs. I think there's about 18 of the SIPs, but we are only participating in terms of particular aspects. We're not participating at the overarching level of trying to bring our insight of what should be done. But I'm not also passing judgment in terms of how the PICC is being run. We are there on their invitation and particular aspects. I don't know if the principal want to introduce SIP for involved.
Okay, very briefly, we participate in SIP 1, which is on Friday, and then we participate in SIP 9 and 10. Which is a collaborative that they join together. In terms of the Infrastructure Act says that the CIDB shall participate in the PICC some committee. A name has been put forward, but we've never been approached to attend a PICC meeting yet.
And then there was a question on stimulation of economic growth as a point of interest and as a point of departure. I think the slide speaking to the shrinking, the inability to spend budgets, is communicating a very clear message. You can never stimulate economical growth when the pie is shrinking. Even the NDP is speaking on the need that growth enables the stimulation of economical growth. At the moment, the pie is shrinking, which invariably means competition is increasing, there's a higher level of concentration. I don't know if I'm addressing all of the issues that you asked there. And yeah, with under expenditure also contributing. That is the fundamental challenge. Yeah, you can add.
If I could make a further comment, and I heard your statement, is that infrastructure should be stimulating economic growth. Why are we not seeing economic growth? Infrastructure, solid good infrastructure, is a prerequisite for economic growth, but not a sufficient condition. On top of that, one needs stability in economics, all those other instruments or all those other factors which stimulate economic growth. But without infrastructure to move goods and transport around and get access, you won't get economic growth. But infrastructure alone does not create economic growth. It just provides the platform on which it can exist.
Chair, through you, on this particular question, there are two issues which we have not explored as a CIDP. It's things that are coming up as I'm thinking and processing the question. The first one is the issue of business cycles. There is the normal business cycle that we know, the one that has highs, the one that has lows, and how it affects everybody in terms of how the business is run. Now, that is a business cycle that is basically dealing with the short to medium term. But construction is also known, in terms of construction economic theory, to have a long cycle, which is known as the Kuznets cycle. That is a much more longer term. I do not believe, if I've ever read any literature of anybody ever doing any work in respect of mapping out South Africa's infrastructure, Kuznets infrastructure cycle, because it's a long-term economic business cycle. It allows you to see which direction you're going in terms of your end game. Are you either going up, or are you going down, or are you just going to stay static? I'm just sharing from what I know. I don't recall ever seeing any research or anybody producing a report that speaks to the Kuznets cycle in respect of construction industry. The second aspect is that there's something also I don't think we have done. When you are looking at infrastructure's contribution to economic growth, there's a distinction between economic infrastructure and social infrastructure. Now, social infrastructure enables and builds social capital, but it adds no impetus in enabling economic growth. Now, within that 40%, maybe there's a question for us as CIDP. We need to look at that and start to say, how do we start to create a separation between the two? Because yes, we are spending a lot on social infrastructure. Maybe the question we should be asking, are we spending the adequate amounts on economic infrastructure that enables economic growth to happen?
That's why we are raising the concern. Maybe our
should
cannot be indulged to just to be in terms of this aspect. I'm not relying on empirical evidence, but I'm going to rely on anecdotal evidence from what I see and what I'm observing. And I want to focus now on economical infrastructure. What I have observed, looking at economical infrastructure in terms of its character, how it looks and where it's existing, is raising a question that is even above the CIDP. It's beyond us. It's actually, I think, there's a policy question that the country needs to start in the future. One level is to ask, if you look at the SIPs, in terms of all of those SIPs, which is where they have some economic infrastructure, and also where they are invested, they are reinforcing the extraction and export economical mode. Now, that does very little, in my view, and understanding of economics, in terms of stimulating economical growth. Because if you look at it, the corridors that are being reinforced by Transnet and others, they are about extraction from the mines and export at the harvest. Then you start to look at the character of the actual expenditure. If we focus on Kusile and the others, the Eskom Build Program, the material component of those projects value was mechanical, electromechanical infrastructure, which were generators and other things which were bought just for installation, not manufactured in South Africa. So they are leaving at GDP level, looks good, but at GNP level, then we don't look good for the money has left. It goes back to the country of production. It raises the issue of how effective our local economic development has been. And also the focus of some of the IDZs. Are they focusing on our ability to be able to support our own infrastructure aspirations or not? Or they're just enabling already an inherited form of production of our economies. So these are my anecdotal observations to say, for as long as that character is not changed, and also how the modality of production is not changed of the economy, doesn't matter how much you spend, that money is not going to stay here, because we're not building the trains here, we're not building those turbines here, etc. We're buying them already ready-made, or we're buying them already as components. Even if we go the route of a green, with these green things that are coming, windmills, or not, if you go and look at Kuha, they arrive already partly assembled. Our job is just now to put them together. That's the example I just want to make, to say the challenge is not that we don't have money. I won't mention which former president who was late when they visited South Africa said, South Africa's problem is they've got too much money. And I tend to have a congruence with that statement, because we are misusing the resources we have. We are not plowing it the right way. The money is leaving the country. And that is what I would want to suggest from a very I'm not an economist, from a very uninformed position of not being an economist. The whole thing of surplus and deficit of our trade account is a function of exactly just that, because the money is leaving. That's where, thanks you for your indulgence, Chair, because it's not our core mandate. I'm just trying to share my understanding, but I will try to focus within the context of our mandate. But I do believe there's a fundamental problem that we can't even change. The money will go there, but it won't stay here. It won't create jobs here. It will create them somewhere else.
Okay. I think that is the point.
Not quite, Chair. I was just looking at my list. Is there any overlap with the CBE? What are our parameters? We don't have overlaps. What we have to do, and I want to look at the DDG IGR is to understand the integrations that we need to do. CBE is responsible for the professions and invariably responsible for the actual, the human bodies. Are they competent in doing what they need to do? The CITB is responsible for the economical entities in which these professionals will then be employed from. So we are interested in the businesses. They are interested in the individual. So there is clear demarcation. We're not on each other's toes, but the issue may be that has our work been synchronized and synergized that we're all pulling in the same direction? You said something else? All right, can I ask Richard?
Okay, let me try and I think we take the point that we say. Thank you, Chairperson. I think we take the point, Chair, that there is a council that's looking to training that maybe we need to interact with at some point. But CITB, we do provide training to clients in as far as our FFU is concerned. What are the things that the clients need to undertake in making sure that they comply with our procurement processes? So we, Richard is our own person who actually goes to each and every province to provide training to clients in respect of a procurement that's related to CITB.
Then ask you, can you indulge us by waiting for the next section, which is talk about effective monitoring on transformation? Because as it gets introduced, there are two aspects of it. One aspect of it speaks to works transformation, which is not speaking to the demographic issues of transformation, but is speaking to how we transform the means of production within the infrastructure sector. To say, how do we change that means of production so that it actually effectively delivers for us, because we've got a particular mode of producing the infrastructure goods, and we have a responsibility then of transforming that environment. Maybe let me present them, Chairperson. I'm looking at the Chairperson of my board. This is for us probably the toughest section of this presentation, because we are still grappling with the issue of how to effect transformation. Firstly, at that level of changing the means of production of the infrastructure sector. Secondly, at the demographic level of saying, do we have the enough women that are represent consistent with the population, black people, disabled people, youth, etc. So, but this we felt is still one of our most difficult sections that we're still grappling with. And maybe let me just say why we are struggling with it. Our act is very explicit on our regulatory function and knowledge function. It is very explicit. But when it comes to the developmental function, it is not explicit. It is implicit. It is something that is read within what we are told to the state to regulate. It, for instance, will say, do 1, 2, 3 and enable development. But development is never the primary thing we are asked to do, not to transform. But it is always secondary to what our act is explicit on, the knowledge area and also regulatory area. But let me then ask Dr. Mulford to cover the next section.
Thank you very much. As the C- CEO said, we will be covering what is referred to here as, very briefly, we'll cover work process transformation, and then secondly, we'll discuss transformation, which is typically defined in terms of ownership. In reading the request to participate here and looking at the definition here, it says transformation of the broad infrastructure sector and how emerging contractors can be supported. We interpreted that as transformation defined in terms of ownership, which was your request. But we just also highlighted, touching very briefly on how do you transform the way construction takes place and how do you transform productivity, health and safety, and the like. A useful reference point is to go back to the white paper on construction, and it spoke there about work process transformation, and it said in the interest of promoting a healthy and competitive industry, and that's clearly what you're aiming to achieve, that delivers value for money in line with international best practice, the public sector has a responsibility to adopt policies which support the goals of improved production practices. And that is very much what we've spoken about. It underpins the SRPDM and underpins much of the CIDB Act. And what are we looking at there? It's improved industry performance depends on improvements in the work process of individual contracting firms in cooperation with clients and professionals. And the key to quality, value for money, the key to minimize disputes, minimize cost overruns, is this collaboration between the contractor, clients, and professionals, and that's what we need to look at. Performance improvement includes the promotion of best practice standards for health and safety, quality, productivity, environmental management, as well as the regulation of labor relations, and I'll touch briefly on how we're trying to drive these best practices into the public sector and also into the private sector. And improved performance also requires a shift towards a partnering approach and the increased adoption of participative management techniques as the basis for less adversarial relationships in the delivery process. I think the partnership process and partnership in construction requires a very mature client and a very mature contractor. It cannot happen where one does not have the competencies to be able to and the skills to deal with that. Our CIDB Act provides that we have to establish the CIDB project assessment scheme, which are based on certain best practice standards. And we have already to date published the standard for developing skills through infrastructure contracts. In terms of the standard, on all public sector contracts in grade 7 to 9, 10% of the labor force should be what is termed unemployed learners. These are people who have finished their theoretical learning and need placement on construction sites. And that's what we're looking for that uptake in the public sector. The standard for indirect targeting for enterprise development through construction work contracts has been published as well, and that talks on all construction projects, 5% of the value must be subcontracted to black contractors together with developmental support. So it's not the 30% in the PPP regulations, this is together with developmental support, and the developmental support is spelled out. We have issued contractor performance reports, which is a mutually agreed performance between contractor, client, and the client's agent. We've issued a best practice of green building construction, one which has come out very recently in response to this trend that we've seen around community involvement, some of the unrest and things like that, is a standard for contract participation goals, where we're saying government clients must use the standard, one must do feasibility study, one must do community consultation, one must have agreements for disputes, resolution and the like. And then also standard for minimum requirements for engaging contractors and subcontractors, amongst others. We want on all public sector projects the main contractor to have a written contract with subcontractors. Amongst others, no contract is leading to exploitation, but it's also been used to avoid paying tax. We are still consulting on a standard for prompt payment. We will be concluding that very shortly. Standard for adjudication, health and safety management plans, primary health care, and here's one on assessing the construction quality. So the approach that we've taken to improve health and safety, quality, environment, and those issues is through encouraging the public sector to adopt these best practices. The regulation for enabling this project assessment scheme, comments closed on the 31st of January, and we are busy making the final decisions and going forward. And this will then be, once regulated, we will check on every government project whether they complied with this, and we're rolling it out in a phased manner. So we're rolling it out, and we're also having one-on-one meetings at the moment. We're scheduling them with the HODs and the municipal managers, and we are asking them, please be aware, please use these. We are not happy with the lack of uptake, even though they've been out there for some time, and that is our strategy. But let me turn now to the transformation really defined in terms of demographics and related. We publish a construction monitor on transformation every year, and a copy has been distributed and it has been made available to you. In that document that we publish, we draw on our register of contractors to look at the state of demographic transformation, black, youth, women, in the contracting sector. We draw on the Construction Sector Charter Council, and we draw on the state of transformation from the Consulting Engineer South Africa. I'm not going to go through too much of the details, but just some highlights. If you look at the professional services sector, that's the consultants, 30% of executives within consulting engineering companies as a percentage of the total executives are black. So only 30%, 37% of executives are black. Less than 40% of large contractors are black owned. And I think this is why you asked the question. It is well, I mean, we see it. Around 30% of contractors are women owned. But in fact, in the women owned sector, we are seeing a steady increase in the number of medium and large. But still, the numbers are nowhere near what we expect. Only 36% of large contractors, that's a grade 7, 8, 9s, 48% of medium-sized contractors have a B level of 1 or 2. Now, that shows how we've got to still move forward. Black-owned contractors accept around 54% of all public sector contracts, and women-owned contractors access around about 25% of public sector contracts. So clearly one can see this is not a normalized industry, and it is very biased to the established sector and the male sector. If one had to try and summarize it, and this is in a recent press release which we said, and in that document you'll see it, it says while the contracting sector is transforming in terms of black ownership at the level of the small contractor, grade level 1, grade level 2, level 3, representation of black-owned medium and large contractors has not increased significantly over the past few years. And if you look at the historic trends, we are seeing we are not getting the change which we need. So at the small contractor, it is relatively highly transformed. But at your medium and your large contractors, there is a huge, huge gap. And then one has to look at what is the country doing, or what is our sector doing, and I'm only going to touch on a few sides here. Clearly, the preferential procurement regulations is the primary regulation to drive transformation in our industry. And with the new PPP regulation states that 4.1, if an organ of state decides to apply pre-qualification criteria to advance certain designated groups, such as black, EMEs, military, whatever the case may be, that organ of state must advertise that tender through a specific tendering condition that only one or more of the following tenderers may respond. Tenderers may have a stipulated minimum BE status. And this is quite a significant, this came out in March 2017, is a significant move forward where previously in terms of the triple PFA, you could only preference on price and BE. Now you can have eligibility. You are able to say for this tender only BE level 1 or BE level 1 and 2 or BE level 1 or 2 or 3 can tender. And that should help. But We see that there is some evidence, but we're not seeing wide evidence of the subtake. We've seen some tenders saying only B level 2 or the like, but we do also note, if done inappropriately, it could lead to market constraints and could lead to price increases. But it is a very important instrument to drive transformation at the medium to high level. The lower level, there is natural. Also, in terms of the preferential procurement regulations, it says subcontracting can be used as a condition of tender. And it says, if feasible, and in the guidance notes, National Treasury says it is feasible unless you prove otherwise, really. On contracts above 30 million, you must apply contract to advance designated groups. And then if you apply subcontracting, then 30% of that tender, of that contract, should be subcontracted to a designated group. Designated group could be black-owned, could be women-owned, it could be youth, it could be rural, it could be EME, QSE. So the opportunities in terms of regulations are there. The challenge now is the uptake, but we are seeing what I would call some abuse of this here. But they are important instruments which must be used properly, which one must consider, and hopefully that will support that change in transformation. What the CIDB is also doing, a very important component of transformation, is through contractor development programs, which many works departments or transport departments have, including National Public Works. These have been established by work departments. Typically, contractors are brought in on a three-year contract, and development and support and training takes place. The CIDB has established the guidelines which should be used for which contractors should be trained to. If we're going to invest government funds in training and developing contractors, we need to know the standard and set the standard which we want contractors to graduate at, and that's what this guideline does. I believe that contractor development programs have significant potential to support your smaller and medium-sized contractors. However, the results that we're getting to date does not support that these programs are being run properly, and we've got to tighten this up. So we would encourage SCOA to encourage effective uptake of CDPs. Use CDPs, but do them properly. Another instrument which the CIDB has introduced, which should be encouraged, I've already mentioned, we've issued the CIDB standard for indirect targeting. It talks about on grade 7 to 9 contracts, 5% of the work, and we aim to move that 5% up to 10%, and probably higher, must be subcontracted together with developmental support, which is agreed in writing and becomes a contract condition. We encourage all client departments to use the standard. Regrettably, very few client departments are using this, and this is why we're now going out on this one-on-one. And we ask in the ESCOMs, the Transnets, the SANROLs, help us, why are we not using this? We need to apply this. One of the big constraints facing small contractors is lack of access to credit. And for your small contractor, lack of access to credit is becoming a more significant constraint than, say, a year or two ago. We do have a draft strategy, the CIDB, and what I'm just doing is highlighting what the CIDB is doing and which you can encourage that support, growth of emerging contractors. We are working with a small enterprise finance agency which provides loans up to a value of 5 million rand. We are looking at, through what we call the best practice fee, to set up an initial capital fund over 5 years of 500 million rand, which will be used to provide loans to grade 1 to 6 or 2 to 6 CIDB registered contractors. And clearly, we will preference black, women and youth-owned contractors through this fund. We are busy developing the MOA at the moment that we aim to fund receive it. So these are some of the interventions that the CIDB is putting in place. Our annual performance plan also we recognize, and we will be implementing what we call business advisory services, And in our provincial offices, we will be establishing services whereby your small and possibly your medium, but really focusing on your small contractors, can come in and request advice on how to develop a business plan, where to get information on health and safety regulations. We're busy designing the strategy, and that will be in place by the middle of this calendar year or so. I want to highlight one issue here, is we produced a practice note called development, procurement, empowerment, development and procurement. And there are many cases where we believe and where government is committed to using infrastructure financing, infrastructure funding to support the development of the previously disadvantaged sector. But there are many cases which we are seeing where the client departments have not given consideration to this. One such example is where one can unbundle, may not be the words, but to allocate projects in the smallest project size so that more and more contractors can get access to it, subject to productivity, risk management, your increased management, the rest. And we produced a practice note which essentially just says to clients, consider it, make a conscious decision. The instruments all exist. But yet again, the uptake from clients is limited. So, Chair, that is my last slide here. I'm trying to highlight, as in summary, we know transformation is not progressing at any reasonable pace or the pace we desire, specifically at the medium to high level contractors. But there are projects, there are instruments, there are tools which can play a role. Beyond the triple PFA, there are instruments and tools. In many cases, the uptake by clients is not satisfactory. We pause there.
Just an intervention. I would want to ask the committee to focus on slide 49. If you do watch some of the broadcasters that we have in the country, news broadcasters, you would have noted on Sunday there was a program, what is it called? Checkpoint, or ENCA. And it was raising I don't want to characterize it in any particular fashion, what is transpiring in KZN in particular around the issue of 30% subcontracting. Now, from an oversight perspective, that bullet number 3, the subcontracting is a condition of tender. I just want to read. It says, the organ of state must make available the list of all suppliers registered on a database approved by National Treasury to provide the required goods or from which a tenderer must select a supplier. Now, there is an issue we want maybe the committee to assist us with. Why is this conditional on the approval of National Treasury? They are tampering with the powers of the respective accounting officers, and for that provision of allowing the 30% to be set aside for suppliers. And there's an issue that says, what is the criteria Treasury is using to us where it's not visible or known, and why are they tampering with the powers of accounting officers in this particular fashion? And the industry itself, because they are starting now to want to dictate using state power who you should and who you can't use. And if you reflect back on what was reflected in that particular show, there is not a use of state power. There is, you can say, bordering on criminality, people demanding to be given work. But the issue is that now here, you've got a reflection on the mirror from the state now wanting to same thing, and there's a question of appropriateness. Thanks, Chair.
Mm-hmm.
To that one, that information is given in the construction monitor, and I'm talking from memory, just trying to look at the pictures, but typically in what we call grade 7 and 8, typically those contractors would be, around about 60% of those contractors would be black-owned, and less so, and as we're saying, it decreases as you go up. But let's just use the number 60% of grade 7, 8 contractors are black owned, typically they would generate about 50% of the work. So it's not in proportion even with the ratio of the number of contractors.
Can you allow us that we can look at this also differently? I hear the response from my question, but I think within your question, there's a question of saying, yes, we know that they are operating at this grade level in terms of where they can operate, but in terms of project awards that have been awarded, how much are they actually getting? Do we have that so that we can provide it?
There is one additional one because of the way your request was structured, and we have dealt with, but I'll be very brief. We've dealt with the oversight on programs, and this will touch very briefly on the oversight of projects. So here we're talking about projects, not portfolios. And all that this slide is some questions you could possibly want to look when you go out to visit a project. Now I reflect on that one you said, you went out and there was a concrete. I think the first question is, say, what is this project value? Now, other than housing, is this contractor registered with the CIDB? You know, these are some of the basic starting points. If it is housing, residential housing, is the contractor registered with the National Home Builders Registration Council? It will be useful to ask. They may or may not know the answer. Certainly the contractor won't, but it's a response to the client. And if you talk to the client, is the project registered on the CIDB register? That's the only way we're going to build up this database of this information. And it's huge. If I could just interject, this is the only instrument that we have to the register projects from which we can determine how much work was awarded to black contractors. And if we're not getting this information, we can't do that assessment. If the project is over 30 million rand, does it have a construction permit that's been issued from the Department of Labor? And is it visible on the site? So these are just some of the questions. And then one can tie it back to what was discussed previously. What was the contracting strategy used? And I think one must ask the client, are you satisfied with the overall performance of the contractor? And if the client says not, then I think you should ask, how could the procurement process be been done to improve? And those are the type of questions. Are you happy? If not, how could it be improved? Are you satisfied with the quality of the construction works? If not, what action is the client taking? And it's not good enough to leave until the walls are halfway up before you take action. Is the project ahead of schedule, on schedule, or behind? If it's behind schedule, how long is this delay? Now, if you've got delays of 3, 4, 5 months, why? What has the client been doing? What has the contractor been doing? But fundamentally, the client has the contract and is paid. What action is the client taking to address delays? Are you going to be charging financial penalties? If the contract is behind, there should be penalties involved. So these are the type of questions that one could explore. I've referred to this. Does a written contract exist between the principal contractor and subcontractors? Have there been instances of disputes between the principal contractor and the client, or the subcontractor and the principal contractor? And if there had been disputes, how were they resolved? And we, for most disputes, we advocate adjudication. You should maybe be asking, have there been any unprotected work stoppages on your sites? Now, one can argue unprotected work stoppages, it's due to labor or community issues, but very often it is influenced by inappropriate actions which could have been resolved by the contractor up front. Not always, but it's worth asking the question. The Department of Labor has got inspectors, and they go around and they can close down construction sites, and they can issue what they call contravention notices. You're contravening the health and safety regulations. You need to improve this or stop work until you've fixed it. And it's useful to ask, when you go on your sites, has there been any of that on these sites? And have there been any injuries, reportable injuries? Those are some of the questions which may lead to it. Payment. Ask the contractor, ask the client. Are you still waiting for your payment or do you have it? And this is destroying the industry. Are there any currently disputed invoices? Because sometimes the contractor will submit invoices, but they're not in line with the work done, it's become disputed, whatever the case. But in some cases, clients, because of the systems, it is going slowly through the process before it gets paid. Ask the question, principal contractor, what is the BE level? I mean, it's done in terms of an award, but it's useful, possibly, to get a feel for which contractors are undertaking which work. What are the level of black women and youth ownership? If it's over 30 million, was the 30% subcontracting rule applied? And which target groups? If it's over 13 million, was a requirement specified for the use of the CIDB standard for indirect targeting to help drive transformation? Did you use the standard for developing skills, CIDB standard? Could the contract have been cut down into smaller ones? It's not always possible, and in some cases where you know you want to bundle them up for management purposes, but in many cases you can unbundle projects and give smaller contractors opportunities. Was it considered? And then lastly, and there's a difference between the 30% and the contract participation goals. The 30% subcontracting does not state the geographic area. Contract participation goals state geographic area. One could ask, were contract participations used for the targeting of enterprises, contractors, or labour? Was community consultation undertaken? What value the project has been undertaken by local enterprises? And how much local labour has been used? And I think those are important questions because we're trying to drive responsible uptake as a means of addressing the unemployment and as a means of addressing development opportunities. So that was a very brief touch on some of the questions that could be addressed at a contract level. I can respond, you won't know.
Okay.
Now, but the important point is, did the client consider? And that is the question one is testing. Did the client make a conscious decision?
Right.
Those words there come from Lesotho Highlands Development Corporation's website.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the instructions that they will give the professional design team. So it's a conscious decision. Yes, we thought about it. No, we didn't. But you can't regulate it because you don't know whether it's 1% or 50%.
Chair, if you allow me, there was another question that was asked. Are there any other matters that strategy you want to address? This is only two exercises, but I do believe that they are very powerful. Because they go with the heart of how budgets are allotted, how budgets will be spent, and how we're held accountable for them. Our Act asks the CIDB to follow up to promote sustainable growth of the construction industry and the participation of the emerging sector therein. And it then further says the board must, which is for me a very important part in legal terms, consult with all organs of state to identify construction-related budgets and the application thereof. That is what we are asked to do by our Act. We've done an assessment of compliance with our mandate, and we've come to a realization that we have not done this particular aspect. We are also
opportunity to firstly to make ourselves accountable to this committee that is responsible for appropriation to say, one, we have not done this, but we are looking for support from the Standing Committee on Appropriations on how we can start to fix this. We do not have the manpower to go to all departments, but we do believe that if we can find a mechanism and also be counseled in terms of how and what levels should we actually start to participate and to be able to fulfill this mandate, it will go a long way in improving the situation around infrastructure delivery and procurement management. I think that is the first thing. It's firstly acknowledging that we have a problem, but there's also a call for help. The other aspect, the other aspect is what I've already responded to earlier, the role of GIAMA, where we're saying GIAMA has not been elevated to the level it deserves in the budgeting process, just like the Public Service Act, the PFMA, as I've explained earlier, because it brings together the standards for uniformity, the standards, the infrastructure delivery management system, and it makes everything gel. And what is beautiful about the standard, it deals with the problem of the Act of GIAMA, because the Act of GIAMA only applies to national or provincial levels. It doesn't extend beyond those spheres of government. And if you were to look into the budgets of infrastructure, majority of the budgets of infrastructure sitting on the provincial level, not in national and provincial. So there's the issue of the request for the elevation of GIAMA, of saying it needs to find its rightful place in the budgeting processes. Thanks, Chair.
I was just going to ask, would it be possible for us as a committee to write a letter to the heads of the departments, just pointing it out to them and ask them individually to make contact with the CIDB?
Thank you. Honorable Chair, honorable members, colleagues, first let us thank the committee for giving us time. We did disclaim a little earlier when we started that we are not experts in training, and so we hope what we did as an effort, we were able to get through to you and empower you with the knowledge that you would need. But we are not gone as we live here. We remain a tool that is available to you to use in the event that there's any clarification or further questions that you may wish to pose through us. So we appreciate the effort, and we appreciate the time that you have given us as well, because I think not only by you wanting to know, but also by the questions that you've raised, you've also sharpened, so to speak, our focus on the issues that you've raised. So when we go back, we must now think about things that we had not thought about prior to coming here. But you've also assisted us in just looking at our business again. There's nothing more embarrassing than someone asking you about your business and you're not able to tell them what you do. So we appreciate that a lot. And again, we remain at your service, not only today, into the future, we remain available. We also hope to learn and grow from this experience ourselves and perhaps do a lot better than we have been doing in the past. So on behalf of my team, may I extend our gratitude and thank you.
Workshop with the team from CIG. Thank you.